Good evening and welcome to Radio Edutalk. My name's David Noble and I'll get to be as ever and delighted to welcome to the show this evening Liz Lakin of the University of Dundee, and this evening we're going to be talking about developing independent learners in science. Good evening, Liz.
Good evening, David.
Okay. And just to start off with, could you give us a kind of brief background to your career in education?
Yes. I graduated from the University of Durham in the late 1970s with a Bachelor of Education degree, teaching in secondary science, particularly biology. My degree was in biology. And I then went on to teach for the best part of 10 years in London. And then I started moving further up the country and went to Gloucestershire and was teaching in a secondary school in Gloucestershire. Shortly after that, I got involved with what was at the time Cheltenham and Gloucester College of Higher Education, and was particularly interested in getting into initial teacher education. And there was a need at the time, not so much for secondary teachers and teacher educators, but more for primary. So I first felt a little bit out of my depth, and I thought, right, well, I want to do this. So I spent the best part of the following year on a sort of weekly basis going into the local primary school near where I used to live and where my children were students, pupils, and spent quite a bit of time there and learned a lot about the primary education system, and then went on to be an initial teacher educator in what then became the University of Gloucestershire. Things moved on from that, and I moved a little bit further up the country to Cumbria, where I assumed the role at the University of Cumbria of head of science education. And it was there that I then moved on finally up to Dundee. And my move to Dundee is an interesting one. I literally sidestepped, if you like, spent the best part of 3 years on a fixed-term contract in life sciences. So I was back, if you like, in the classroom, but a very, very different classroom, And from there, when the contract ended, the opportunity arose for me to move into the area of education again that I sort of started off with. And here I am, a senior lecturer in education at the University of Dundee.
Okay, and we're going to hear about this theme about independent learning and the sciences, and we're going to be kind of talking around aspects of a recent book that was written by yourself. So can you just introduce the book to us and give us an idea about where the idea came from?
Yes, really, in a way, it goes right the way back to my time in Gloucestershire, because I was fortunate to be working very closely with a team of colleagues who were interested in research and interested in working very closely with the teachers in the local community and, you know, looking at publishing the research. And from that, I got particularly interested in this whole idea of independent learning. What I will say right from the outset is that, to me, an independent learner isn't somebody who is working by themselves. They could be, but that's not what I understand by the term independent learning, and I'll say a little bit more about that as we move on. But the book sort of emanated from the time when I was doing quite a lot of continued professional development with local teachers in Gloucestershire, and then when I moved up to Cumbria, sort of carried on, and I was working very closely with my own students at the university, you know, initial teacher education students, and looking at the way that they were developing their learning, and we were, you know, how that was then applied in the classroom. And so this whole idea of developing sort of rounded and autonomous people, whether they're teachers, whether they're pupils or whatever they are, was very important to me. And it became something that I guess I really began to focus on more and more, and eventually that's what my PhD is in. So it was from the work that came out of the PhD, but also the work that led up to the PhD and beyond, that really formed the book. And it was from doing a series of workshops at the Association of Science Education's annual conferences over the years that I got a lot of the material to pull together into the book. And when I was asked to do it, it was really just like writing my own history in a way.
Wow. Wow. And I suppose at this point, Liz, it would be helpful if you could just give us a kind of full title of the text then, just in case people want to kind of pull it up on screen either now or after the show, and who indeed it's published by.
Yes, it's called Developing Independent Learning in Science, Practical Ideas and Activities for 7 to 12-year-olds, and it's published by the Open University Press, McGraw-Hill Education.
I'm interested, not being from a sciences background myself, but can you give us a kind of idea then from I know you reference many pieces of research and all of your work and in this particular book, but can you kind of characterise what the problems are currently or have been recently in terms of the approach to the education around the sciences?
I think one of the there's two main areas. One, the fact that students coming through, not necessarily directly out of primary schools into secondary, but more from secondary into higher education and then into employment. And there's a big drive at the moment to look very closely at the type of skills that our students are developing as they come through the education system and into higher education. And there seems to be a well-recognised skills gap in terms of transferable skills and skills that employers are looking for, particularly in the sciences. And these are going to be, higher level skills of thinking skills, communication skills, critical analysis, reflection, all this type of thing, which we hear a great deal about, and we're working on in various to various degrees, but that seems to be one of the key areas that was a driver for me to look at how we could actually develop and enhance the development of these skills really from an early age. So, the idea of problem solving and application and, like I say, reflection and evaluation, they're quite challenging skills in their own right, but I believe quite strongly that you can start on the development of these skills at quite an early age.
And it's mentioned that the development of these skills could possibly start even as young as seven. So I'm just wondering, I don't know if it's an either or, but what are the particular problems then that research shows up with, for example, science education in primary? Is it, for example, that just the right skill sets are not being taught to then move into eventually tertiary education? Or is it, we've also heard, I think, in the press recently in Scotland about primary teachers maybe not being as confident to deliver aspects of science education?
I think it's got a lot to do with all of that, actually. The confidence side of things is... that's one of the things that I do. The way I've written the book, it's very much a sort of journey that, in effect, the teacher's actually going through, because it's written in a, I suppose, for a book like this, in a unique sort of way, because it's talking directly to the teacher, and it's encouraging the teacher to analyse their own learning and to, to look at the way that they learn things, look at the processes they go through. And the second chapter in particular brings in, I was asked by OUP to bring in a level of academic rigour to it, and they wanted some philosophy brought in there, which I was very keen to do. And looking in particular at the process of our understanding of science, because I think one of the big problems is that science teaching in schools tends to be, at the end of the day, very much assessment-led. It's the same for a lot of other subjects as well, but... in effect, that's almost going contrary to what we're trying to put across when we consider the actual scientific process itself. We're not always necessarily, in fact, seldom are we looking for right answers. And we don't know if the answers we've got are right. We have to keep testing them. And the problem is the way that we tend to teach science in schools in a lot of cases ends up looking for a right answer. And I found this was really quite a problem with some of my students when I was in life sciences, that we were giving them sort of open-ended problem-solving activities in the lab. And quite a lot of them early on were really struggling because they weren't being asked for a right answer as such. And it was turning everything that they'd learned in the past on its head, and they were feeling right outside their comfort zone.
So the book draws on practice-based research and kind of bigger studies, philosophical pieces as well, but also encourages, whether it's a student teacher or the primary educator, to reflect and to embark on this journey, I suppose, as they go through the book. So what kind of response have you had from teachers since the book was published?
I would say very positive. And it has been, really, because I think because of the way it was written, because of the style it's written in, it really does take you through the journey. And a lot of teachers were saying that they liked the personal approach, and they liked the easy way in which it flowed and the way that they were challenged. So later on in the book, the chapters 3, 4, and 5 are the ones with sort of strategies and activities and what have you, which are related directly to the classroom. And a lot of teachers obviously really like those. Chapter 4 in particular is all about questioning and, looking at deep questions and looking using all aspects of Bloom's taxonomy, which I'm sure a lot of teachers listening to the programme will appreciate. But actually setting it through contexts that particularly primary school teachers, I hope, will, the feedback I've got, have really sort of aligned with. One particular activity is taking the nursery rhyme Humpty Dumpty and trying to come up with a whole series of questions addressing the various levels of Bloom's taxonomy, which actually gets increasingly more challenging. One of the best ones that came through, which I do quote in the book, is to do with creativity. And the big question was, did he fall or was he pushed? And that sort of turns it all on its head, which is quite nice. And teachers really like that sort of approach.
And so your argument throughout the book then is for, active learning, plenty of opportunities for problem solving, but also approaches around peer assessment and dialogue between the pupil and the teacher. So maybe pick one or two of those areas. I know they're very broad, and just give us a few more ideas about possible strategies and techniques.
Yes, by all means. Chapter 3 looks at existing strategies, because there's a lot of good practice out there, a heck of a lot of good practice out there, and this was coming through from research that I was either involved with directly or was fully aware of as a result of my PhD. And I wanted to make sure that all of these activities can be recognised and can be used. And in Chapter 3, where I was looking at feedback and the importance of feedback in relation to assessment for learning and assessment informing learning and what have you, I was using a whole variety of different sort of approaches. I'm just turning to it now, so you can excuse me for a moment. One example came from, I'd been asked to go to a local school in Gloucestershire and work with the, this was a piece, the equivalent of a P6 group of children, and the teacher was looking at, they were looking to introduce the idea of food and farming to the class. And we spent some time with a local farm, and we were looking at making some fertilizer and various other things like that. But the teacher in particular wanted to have some form of assessment, which wasn't going to be, the formal sort of test or anything writing necessarily. It was just really to test their understanding of what, and assess their understanding of what the whole topic had been about. And in the end, we challenged them with this idea of writing a play and putting together a play which they could then all take part in and present to the parents. And this was to do with, it was entitled, in fact, they came up with the title, they called it Dilemma. And it was to do with farmers with factory hens and to do with farmers with free-range free-range eggs. And, looking at the challenge that Mrs. Hoity Toity, who was going to be the main character, had to make her Christmas cake, what type of eggs to use. And the children went through and came up with the main essence of the play. And then they decided to ask the parents what they felt should actually happen and what the outcome would be. And it was really quite interesting, because this led into quite a nice sort of debate which the children then took back to the classroom afterwards. But the idea of it was so that the teacher could, as the children were going through this development process, was able to sort of tease out some of the things, some of the misconceptions that the children have, but equally to sort of reinforce any of the ideas that she got, which she wasn't, which she was putting across, which she felt that perhaps the children didn't quite get to grips with as they were going through the learning process earlier on. So that was one particular example. There's another one. I went into another primary school and was working with some, I think this would be the equivalent of P3 children, and we were looking at light and reflection, and we were doing some work on that. And what was quite interesting was that I felt that the lesson had gone really well, and it wasn't. And I wanted to go back and see the children about 6 weeks later, just to sort of see how much had they gone in, and to discuss their understanding of light and shadows. And it was light and shadows, not light and reflection. It was light and shadows, and they'd given them this this drawing of two people, and asked them to draw their shadows. And I was looking for the usual thing, you know, are these shadows sort of connected to the feet of these people, and were they just blackened out? They were proper shadows as opposed to reflection. And to my horror, one child drew the most beautiful image, a mirror image of these two characters. And that just threw me 10 left, and it wasn't until I then spent some time talking with this little girl and to find out why it was that she'd drawn an image of reflection rather than of a shadow, and it materialised that she'd been absent at the time of the lesson that we had when I went in to do it originally. And that really made me think about the importance of not just getting feedback, but understanding what that feedback is and means, and talking it through with the children themselves. So that was another example of, using assessment for learning, but really using it to inform future practice and what have you.
Yeah, and it sounds from the examples you've given, Liz, that it's important that the teacher is not so much front and centre all the time, but can be facilitating the learning. But when it's with younger children, they certainly shouldn't be too far away at any point, because there's a need for important input at the right time, and crucially, I suppose, clarification.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that perhaps could be said in opposition to a book like this, you're talking about independent learning, and it's sort of the flagged up as moving away from the dependency on the teacher, and you then begin to think, oh heck, what's the role of the teacher? But actually, the teacher's role is even more important, I think, because the teacher does take on a role of being a facilitator. They're the ones who will provide the opportunities to help the children develop these skills and their understanding, and to construct meaning. They'll be the ones who sort of set the context. They'll be the ones who will set the problem-solving ideas and present them, and then talk them through and, like I say, really act as a facilitator, as a mediator, and various other roles.
Mm-hmm. One part of the book, you mentioned things... Other ideas around focusing on the big picture as well as the minutiae, and about applying learning in different contexts. And that got me thinking about, do you have anything to say in the kind of ideal environments then, possibly non-traditional classroom settings for science education? And you also write about recognising alternative ideas and different ways of seeing things. So again, can you give us any examples in any of these areas?
There was one particular active, and towards the end of the book, it's chapter 5, talk a lot there about the whole idea of a learning community. And this really is where the notion of the real essence of independent learning for me comes in. As I go through the book, I emphasise that these independent learners are autonomous in their thinking. They are creative. They do start challenging their understanding and what have you. But most importantly, they need to reformulate these ideas. They need to be able to test them out, to try them out. And the only way they're really going to be able to do that is by talking and working in groups with other children, with adults, and really, you know, sort of testing out the ideas. And the one of the examples I give is Goldilocks and the Just Right Porridge. And in a way, I mean, these activities, I'm sure a lot of people will recognise, you know, the essence of them. But what I've tried to do is give them a slightly different twist and emphasise the real sort of problem-solving element, but also where it goes to, what happens at the end. And this particular one was taking the classic situation of Goldilocks and, you know, she tries out the three different types of porridge, and the children here are working in you know, typical groups, and they have to do an investigation based on trying to keep the porridge at just the right temperature. So this is a problem-solving insulation-based thing, which I'm sure a lot of, you know, primary school teachers have done. But the important thing towards the end is what they do with the information, and encouraging them to look back and think about the fitness for purpose for the actual process they've gone through. So they're beginning to evaluate it. So that's introducing the idea of working in groups and, you know, sort of testing out ideas. But I take that further with an activity which I call Cinderella's Slipper. And this really is the essence for me of what a learning community is about, because it emphasizes the fact that, you know, each of us have our own particular expertise. And we bring those expertise to whatever job it is we're doing. And what I was trying to emphasize here is that there's going to be children in the group who are going to be particularly good at certain activities, but maybe need help and assistance with others. So it's really emphasizing the idea of, you know, identifying who are the experts in particular tasks, whether it's in drawing or writing or actually designing something or so on and so forth, and who actually, you know, a bit dodgy about it, or who need help, and who needs help. And, you know, sort of assigning people roles to do with their expertise, but equally helping them in the areas where they're not so good. And that was the idea behind the Cinderella's Slipper, where the children were being asked to design and make a slipper for Cinderella. And they had to go through a whole series of, you know, sort of various processes to do this. And they had to allot roles for people within their group. And they then had to present it and, you know, talk about it at the end. And this sort of approach really is what is now a key feature of things like sort of STEM activities and the Big Bang activities that you may be aware of, that we have sort of up and down these challenges that that are presented to schools for, you know, doing projects and then presenting these projects. So it's all to do with working as a small learning community to achieve a particular goal.
And within the kind of learning communities, is there a place for homework or home challenges, either in the primary age or into secondary?
Yes, absolutely, and most definitely. And that's the final chapter in the book, is looking... this is a colleague of mine, Colin Forster, who works down in the University of Gloucestershire, and he'd done some research into homework, and that had informed a lot of the practice that he was doing, and it seemed only fitting to actually take the, you know, the independent learning stage then out of the classroom, out into the home, out into the, you know, the community in which the children are living. And that chapter's all about that, where, in effect, it turns the idea of homework on its head. It's not going to be something where you're finishing off what you've done in school or... to the absolute extreme, it's where the children can actually identify what areas they want to work on in their own time, what areas they particularly want to develop, and so they can work either in groups or they can work with parents if, you know, they're in a situation where that's possible, or it's something essentially that they really have ownership over. And Colin's found that from the work that he's done on this, that actually it's a lot more beneficial, and it's actually done as opposed to, you know, struggling and fighting with the children to get the homework done and being on time.
This is a question I probably should have asked at the top of the show, and I know we're just coming to the end of tonight's show, Liz, but it's quite philosophical, and I'll probably word it wrongly, but you know, are you making the case that all children are autonomous and are independent, you know, are born creative or with the capacity to be creative, or are you arguing that that we can actually foster it, or we can even introduce it into children's lives, particularly maybe children that are disadvantaged or who have learning barriers?
Yeah, I think we all have the innate ability to do it, either to be autonomous and to be creative, and to, because I mean, if you think about your young babies, and as they start to develop, they're inquisitive, they're touching things, they're testing things out, they're, you know, trying things out, and it's a case of nurturing those skills and nurturing and developing those skills. So I think it's something that, you know, yes, we all have the capability of going along that journey and developing that. We all develop at different times, at different rates, in different ways, and to different degrees. And the questions that we ask are the ones that inform how we look at the world around us and how we interpret it. And I think the idea of this book is actually really sort of getting us to think about what questions are we asking and how are we asking them. And more importantly, to allow us to actually make mistakes and to learn from those mistakes, because that's what, you know, children do all the time. They're not necessarily always given the opportunity to actually, you know, safely make mistakes and actually learn from them.
Mm-hmm. So through this journey, through your book, you know, where these strategies and techniques to, I think it is fascinating, promoting independent learning and science, and yet you know you're at pains to show that the 21st century, that means that it has to be a degree of interdependence and collaboration.
Oh, absolutely.
And just to finish up, Liz, you know, we're hoping to get to a point when, you know, when a child gets to the end of the 3-18 curriculum, that they'll continue to be lifelong learners, the transferable skills and such like that they can take into whatever STEM or non-STEM career. But just remind us again about, you know, where we're at in terms of the STEM subjects post-school. You know, is it, you know, we hear about a low uptake among females, for example, but is it a wider issue about maybe some great engagement, great attainment within the upper reaches of school, but not enough youngsters taking it to into tertiary education?
There really does seem to be an issue to do with, you know, how many children are, how many children going on to pupils and students are actually taking up the sciences, sort of post-16. And I mean, we get a very good intake in life sciences at the university. But you know, how many students actually still take, you know, go on to do the physical sciences? How many, you know, students go on in secondary school to really sort of bed into the sciences? It seems to be a problem in Scotland, a problem nationally. You know, so yes, it's something that's been recognised. And then when you know, the fitness for purpose of what the what we're actually, you know, giving them to then go into work and into employment of some kind or another is questioned by a lot of employers. I mean, this was I suppose prompting the book in the first place to a certain extent. You know, this idea of the skills gap and the fact that a lot of children aren't able to, or a lot of students aren't able to use these particular skills because maybe they've just not developed them far enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just before you go, Liz, you know, what other work are you involved in the moment that teachers of STEM subjects and maybe primary teachers might be interested to hear about or we might read about in the coming months?
Well, I've been particularly involved with the STEM agenda in terms of, you know, I mentioned the Big Bang, and I was asked just recently to go down to Cumbria actually to to be one of the judges at a local school down there, where this was a secondary school where they got some primary schools involved in doing what they refer to as a little Big Bang, which was doing some group projects to do with developing land yachts. And that's something that I'm really quite keen in bringing up into Scotland. And I'm just at the beginning of working with a local school in Fife to see if it's possible to develop this type of approach across some of the primary schools in Fife. So that's something that, you know, watch this space, so to speak. But also from then at the other end of the spectrum, in the university, looking at how we develop these independent learning skills. Beginning to do this in life sciences when I was part of the team there, and it's something that's now coming through with my students in education. So, you know, developing these skills, particularly in science, is something that we're doing, and I'm doing some research into that here at the university.
Great stuff, and I'll just remind listeners, you've been listening to Liz Leakin of the University of Dundee, and if you've got any questions or comments for Liz, I'll be sure to pass them on. You can get in touch with myself in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr at hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up on Twitter with the hashtag edutalk, and as I say, I'll be sure to pass anything on to Liz in the coming days and weeks. Thank you so much for giving up your valuable time this evening, and best wishes for the future.
Thanks very much indeed, David.